Think Again with Borderlands Cooperative.
Join us for critical conversations about things that matter.
Every Friday at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial.
And 3CR Digital, streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
So together, let's think again about important matters affecting us, like economics,
politics,
education,
health,
climate,
and what we can do about it all.
Welcome to our 310th program of Think Again. We're broadcasting from the 3CR studio on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Think Again is a program of Borderlands Cooperative, an organisation working for social change for nearly 30 years now. I'm Jennifer Burrell, your host today. Jacques isn't here, but I'm joined by Dr. Bob Davidson, who is an honorary research fellow at Macquarie University. Bob will be talking about the neoliberal takeover of our human services since the 1980s. Human services across the board, from disability and aged care to most of our health and education services. Welcome to the program, Bob Davidson.
Good to be here, Jennifer. Thanks for inviting me.
Real pleasure. So first of all, jumping into it, Bob, can you tell us what you mean by neoliberalism? We use the word a lot, but what do you mean by it when you use that term? And can you tell us a bit about the history of neoliberalism taking over our human services over the last 40 years or so?
Okay. Well, neoliberalism is a term that's been defined and applied in many ways, and its meaning's actually changed from when it was first used and adopted by the adherents in 1938. But there's two points I think are accepted by everybody. It draws on neoclassical economics and libertarian philosophy, and it's ostensibly based on a belief in personal liberty, responsibility, power of individuals, the power of markets, and the need to limit the size and power of government and other collective action, so unions and the third sector. And secondly, it's a movement that's been massively successful over the last 40 years in shaping public policy, transforming economic social life internationally along the lines of those beliefs. Mm-hmm. It promotes the idea of a minimal state, and so it's opposed to planning, regulation and other forms of government involvement in its purest form.
So, Bob, just a small interception. When you say successful, you don't mean it's worked well. You mean it's been successful and having the agenda.
Oh, yes, sorry, it's been massively successful politically in taking over the world, as distinct from massively successful in achieving what it claims to be going to achieve. Yes, absolutely. Sorry, Jennifer.
That's all right. Thank you for the clarification.
So as well as a set of processes and mechanisms and structures, it's most powerfully, I think, a mindset of how people perceive the world, the balance between the state, the market and the third sector, and how one thinks goods and services should be produced and delivered. And where did it come from? Well, it's really a return to the, it's back to the past. Government gradually developed legislation and services to empower the great masses of people, and this reached its peak in the 30 years after World War II with Keynesian economics and the development of the welfare state. Mm-hmm. Now, that post-war period is regarded by many as golden years of growing prosperity and equality, but the conservatives never went away. In 1947, the Mont-Pelerin Society was formed, and people will know names like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. And their role was to develop a counter-world. And they sat there for 20, 30 years developing this vision. And then when the economic problems of the 70s came, the inflationary effect of Vietnam and the OPEC oil rises, that gave them their opportunity. And from there had been some things they'd been involved in earlier, but essentially it's the election of Thatcher in 79 and Reagan in 80 that really marks the beginning of the dominance of neoliberalism. And others were brought on board. So that's the history of neoliberalism.
Yeah, and for our younger listeners, that was Thatcher in the UK and Reagan in the US.
Oh, sorry, that's right, And they were very tied to those processes. In Australia, the thrust of a Hawke government reform was essentially a neoliberal one. When Hawke was elected, that wasn't planned or expected, at least not publicly, but by about 84, 85, it was starting to happen. And then the Greiner in 91, Kennett in 92 were the first state governments to move.
So that was Greiner in the New South Wales?
New South Wales and Kennett in Victoria.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm carbon dating myself a bit here, General. We're the first state governments to move. Now, the truth is that over time, Labor has often led the charge to neoliberalism, albeit that the Liberal governments have tended to come along behind and turbocharged it.
Yeah,
and I think Labor has actually introduced a lot of these things.
Yeah, I vaguely remember Liberals complaining that Labor had taken all their policies in the 80s.
That's right. Very much so, yeah. Now, that's the question, what drives it and what continues to drive it? Three main things. One is it's a philosophy and ideology. There are people who believe this is the best way for society to function. Mm-hmm. Then secondly, there's politics. Governments have thought they could avoid responsibility by removing or distancing themselves from being hands-on, mm-hmm. even though they've remained funding it. And, of course, as time has shown, that doesn't absolve governments from public responsibility. Yeah. Eventually, it's governments that get called on to fix up the problems. And finally, there's the private benefits. There's massive financial power arising from greater access to the levers to power and the public purse. So the private sector, if you go back to the 70s, most government programs were either run by a government agency or by non-profit bodies funded by government. That has changed massively in the last 45 years. So in general, we've seen privatisation, corporatisation, deregulation, especially finance and banking in the labour market, and massively reduced protection for industries and workers.
Yeah.
Economic activity and wealth's grown substantively, but that's been shared less equally, as people will know.
Yeah.
Again, older listeners might remember that it was originally claimed that this would all create a bigger pie, and so the losers from neoliberalism could be compensated and everybody would be better off. But then, after it all happened, it was then claimed, oh, redistribution will damage the incentives of the so-called wealth makers. So people got the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, so that probably leads me into my next question. Thanks for that great overview. And I think, as we've discussed, is there's a lot of listeners who aren't as old as you or I, who wouldn't know another world. So it's really good to have this contextual history. And I guess I want to ask you something you've started answering, really. How has the neoliberal turn worked out for our human services?
Okay. Well, it firstly didn't affect human services for about 10 years to the late 80s, early 90s. And it's mainly been, mainly occurred via what's called marketisation, which has involved the introduction and expansion of market mechanisms. What do I mean by market mechanisms? Without getting too complicated, it's things like contestability, competition, greater user choice, co-payments, prices, profit motives, deregulation, and individualisation has been very important. The way funding's provided directly to people, not to providers, and then requiring people to be more responsible for arranging, managing and assessing the services they receive. Which, when you're talking about the sort of people who are receiving services, they're very vulnerable, lacking a lot of skills, and it makes it very hard for them to actually function in that world. But that's the other side of the coin of individualising services.
Individual management and administration.
That's right, yeah, yeah. While you don't have to self-manage your fund, there are still a lot of things you've got to do yourself. Now, it was always claimed that this would lead to more responsive providers, higher quality services, greater efficiency, lower costs, all of those things. The reality is, of course, that we've often seen the opposite. So something like transparency was always trumpeted as because the market decisions wouldn't be made behind closed doors in government departments, we'd know more about it. What we've seen is the reverse, quite the opposite of that, that we've now hit with a wall of commercial inconfidence. We can't find anything out because governments, providers claim and governments support them in the idea that this is all commercial in confidence. So far from getting greater transparency, we've actually got less transparency. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest problem has been that we have less control over the entry of service providers. Mm-hmm. Mark Butler, in talking to the press club the other day, as the minister, expressed concern. The NDIS has 260,000 providers.
Mm-hmm.
That's not people receiving, that's providers. That's 1% of Australians provide services under the NDIS.
Mm-hmm.
Only 16,000 of those are actually registered by the NDIS. The others just put in their bills and get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And Butler's certainly going to try and rectify that. You have a look at some of the players that we've seen a lot of problems with childcare recently. And we've had an Aged Care Royal Commission. I think it's true to say that there really hasn't been any sector that's been hugely and extensively marketized that hasn't ended up at some stage with public scandals and hasn't ended up with someone saying the system is broken. Again, Butler was saying the other day that some large, I think it's 16% or something of Australians believe the NDIS is broken.
Yeah.
So this has been a continuing tale with the services. That's not to say that some people haven't benefited from these market mechanisms, not to say that a lot of people weren't affected by them. But there are sufficient numbers that have had problems, and the sectors themselves always end up in some sort of public debacle.
Mm.
People might remember in vocational education and training where TAFE was downsized and all sorts of cowboys came in. And one of the best stories I can recall is, I can't think of the name of the company or the guy now, but he started up a TAFE, educational training company in Victoria. And he was said, and he was quite right, that all his contract required him to do was to sign people up. It didn't actually require him to provide any services.
Mm.
So that's the state that some of these sectors got into. They were badly managed, too many allowed to get in, too many poor and opportunist providers allowed to get in. And we've seen inquiry after inquiry.
Yeah.
I'd say, however, that most providers are probably genuine. But we've got a sort of tail wagging the dog where everybody's got to follow regulations to stop 10% of bad providers or dodgy providers operating. And that affects everybody else. The other 90% can't get on with it.
And those bad providers are probably accounting for a substantial amount of taxpayers' money being siphoned to inappropriately to private profiteers.
Well, that's I think what the NDIS are saying at the moment, that that's what's happened, and they're trying to bring that back into control. But I think I'd make the point, that I think most providers are trying their best, but they get sucked into a situation where there's massive commercial pressures, and they have to respond to those or they don't survive.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, you see less staff, you see lower qualified staff. And this goes right down to the level of the quantity and quality of food that is given to people in nursing homes.
It's terrible. I'll just remind listeners, you're listening to Think Again, 3CR 855 AM on your dial, 3CR Digital and streaming at 3cr.org.au. I'm Jennifer Burrell, and today we have Dr. Bob Davidson on the line talking about how neoliberalism has taken over our human services over the past 40 years or so and some of the issues and the fallout from this. So, Bob, you started talking about the NDIS there, and you came to my attention because of your chapter in a book called Captured, which we'll put on our program page. And this book, Captured, looks at neoliberalism across a number of sectors, which, and it was kindly loaned to me, the book by Karina at our station. Thank you, Karina. So you wrote, in your chapter in Captured, you wrote about the effect of neoliberalism on the NDIS, and using the NDIS as an example, what do you see as some of the problems of the neoliberal approach, perhaps building on what you were, what you've already been saying?
I just first make a point, and I meant to make it earlier, Jennifer, is that I believe that some level of marketisation is good, that people need some level of choice, they need some level of contestability, so that providers just can't keep getting money forever. And it's particularly important with disadvantaged people. If there's only one provider, one government provider, and that person gets offside with the gatekeeper, they've got nothing.
Yeah. So I think... Yeah. I just in response to that, because I saw that point made in your chapter as well, and I guess for me the broader point is you can't really have a little bit of neoliberalism. That's really the point, because by definition, neoliberalism is the idea of providing government services through the market and market processes and mechanisms. So for me, even predating the neoliberal push, there were always private providers like for physiotherapy and, you know, et cetera. So I think I just want to make that distinction. We're not talking about a little bit of neoliberalism. We're just saying it's okay to have private profit makers in the system. Is that right?
Well, a couple of things. What I'm saying is that there was actually a form of market in those days before the marketisation took over in the 80s.
Yes.
It did. And often you did have a bit of a choice. Sometimes you did in some sectors, sometimes you didn't.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that marketisation is defined by these things like more choice and a number of providers. And you've got to have some of that, otherwise it works against people.
Okay. And
as far as for-profit providers, I wouldn't necessarily exclude them per se, but I cannot see how a properly run system where profit was limited and providers had to give us a lot of information about how they operate, I can't see that the large for-profits would want to stay in such a sector.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people and who have worked in a sector for a long while, know a lot about it, that don't want to work for big bureaucracies, whether they're government or non-profit, and go out on their own and produce very good services. So I don't think you exclude for-profits per se, but you simply cut off the opportunity and incentive for them to make a lot of money, and that will drive out the other ones anyway.
So Bob, in relation to the point you brought up about choice, and I note from your chapter is with the NDIS, that's led to... generally less choice. Can you talk a bit about that? About how people might be eligible for services, but the services just aren't there, for example.
Okay, well, that's often... yes, it depends. What's happened with the NDIS and most of these services is that governments no longer plan the supply of services.
Mm.
They believe by giving people money and setting up... price systems and so on, that somehow the magic of the market, the invisible hand, will ensure that there's supply everywhere. But two things happen. On the one hand, you get some areas where no one goes to, or very few go to, and you'll find that the for-profits tend to be located in the cities.
Mm.
So first of all, you've got that idea that there's no provider of last resort, as governments used to be. There's some people and places get no services at all. And they're often what are described as thin markets, thin because there's very few. But my view is that the thick markets are equally problematic because that's where you get large numbers of providers, many of them pretty poor, lack of capability, integrity, et cetera. And a lot of these things, a lot of these problems that I've been talking about happen there. As well as that, people are faced with a massive options. If anyone reads the Dilbert comic strip, the guy who wrote a book called Thriving on Business Stupidity in the 21st Century, in which he coined the term confusopoly. which is what happens. People are just confused, and they simply don't know what to pick. And it's almost a matter of policy, certainly in aged care, that my aged care can't tell you and give you any advice as to which are the good ones or bad ones. There's a system of, there's the STAR system, but that tends to have been discredited in recent times too. So people are confronted by a mass of providers with no real assistance in many cases as to which are the good ones and which, you know, which are the proven providers.
Which is a huge impost. And also, I was interested in your point about with the removal of block funding to not-for-profits, of course, and some good services that for some people with disability had been connected with for years, them folding without the block funding. There's a focus on that individualised approach, and I think you've talked about inadequate support from group or community or team approaches, or there's a suspicion of collective approaches, and that and they've what's been removed. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's the home and community care program has been changed to home care when 25% of its community. It's almost like community's become an ideological term for the neoliberals. So the idea of individualised funding. Certainly the people, the disability advocates who drove the NDIS believe in it, and I think it's a good thing. But when it becomes the only way things can get funded, then that often removes or reduces the possibility of group and community-based things, which are just as important for people. A big part of people's individuality is being part of a group.
And mental health and well-being.
That's right. And so on the one hand, it can limit people's opportunities. You'll find people with disability, their whole life is with just their care workers because they're not part of group and community things because of the way they're funded. Mm. But it also has a big impact on providers because no longer can providers have some certainty about what funding they're going to have. And that, of course, plays back into the amount of money they put into improving their systems, and also comes back into the security of work for workers. Now, I believe, and this is what has been done with to some extent. This is what has been pushed with by some people in relation to support home care, and I think it's right. Is that to some extent, you don't completely bring back block funding, but you bring back what is called core funding, so that people have enough money. A provider has enough money to be able to plan for the future. And then on top of that, there might be a variable amount depending on the number of people that come to them. Yeah. But at least they can be sure for the next 1, 3 years, whatever, that they have a baseline. Yeah. And they can therefore give staff more security. They can start to put money into improving what they're doing and so on. So individualised funding is generally a positive thing in many ways, but it's got its negatives. It's like all of this, Jennifer, some level of marketisation works. It goes too far. I suppose I'd say there should be a little bit of marketisation. The problem, of course, is that historically what we've seen is that once that's always been extended until we move to a point where it's becoming counterproductive.
Well,
so it's
a very
difficult political thing to battle. Yeah.
And the government giving up all responsibility and putting it out to the market. So for me, the amount of marketisation, it's always been there, even before the neoliberal push, it's always been there. But when you get to a certain tipping point, it qualitatively changes the system.
That's
now,
right.
Bob, I'm mindful we're coming to the end of the program. Another question, which you've already started answering, I think, what could be done to make the NDIS a less marketised model and better able to support people with disabilities?
Okay. First of all, I've outlined it in the book. I've got it in broad terms, and then in a submission that I made to the NDIS review, it's publicly available. I've gone into it in some depth. But essentially, my approach would be to focus very much on the supply side, But I think you've also there needs to be a set of participant market rights. What's happened with the Aged Care Act? We've given people rights, but we no one's actually specified their rights within a market. We also need to look at the way the supply side develops, and that is things like controlling the entry of new providers. Not barring new entrants, but controlling who gets in, making sure that providers give us more information. This whole commercial in confidence, this is public money aimed at assisting vulnerable people. Most of these providers don't do anything special that can't be revealed, and we should know what their operations, finances and outcomes are while they're getting so much public money. So there needs to be much more transparency about that. I think there's a lot more scope to do things from a central base in terms of developing the providers. So the whole care economy and the Productivity Commission, I just can't think of the word they use, but they've sort of latched onto it, that we need to do joint things, that do the training, IT development, rather than leave each little provider to do its own thing, which is a massively inefficient way of doing it when you think about it.
Yeah.
Everyone has to go out and hire an IT person and they all reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
It'd be much better to do these things more jointly. So there's a whole series of things that can be done on what is called the supply side. The huge difficulty, of course, in all of these, and is always the case, is there is never enough money. That is the nature of government funding. And there is not enough people at the moment to provide the sort of workforce for the care economy. And I suppose to the credit of the Albanese government, they have been doing a lot of work in improving the conditions and wages of people in the care economy. And that could make a big difference to the people to come in. So that's there's always the lack of people and money, which in itself isn't a result of neoliberalism. But neoliberalism tends to exacerbate some of the problems.
And I guess it causes them. That's right. And I guess at a management level, as you've also pointed out, there's been a loss of expertise in management with that neoliberal idea that, you know, there's just a core set of skills that managers have to do. And so, and I think with the withdrawal of block funding to support not-for-profits and public service organisations is we've also lost probably a lot of expertise in that. And then you have a lot of smaller players who don't have a background even in the area where they're providing services when the government funding stream becomes available.
Yeah. One of the problems in all of this is that some people say neoliberalism's dead, it's people understand. It's I don't think it is. It's far from dead.
It's entrenched.
It's in the bone marrow of everybody. People who worked, you've got to be over 65 to have worked in a world before neoliberalism.
Yeah, and now, Bob, we really do have maybe just a couple of final sentences and then we might have to let you go.
There's a lot, as I say, there's a lot to absorb in this. We probably only touched the surface today, but I hope it's been of some use to people. You can get hold of those books that we've mentioned, and my submission can be accessed for free, so people who are interested can follow it up a bit more.
That's fantastic, Bob. And you can if you send me some links, I can put some that on our program page as well as a reference to the book. And we would love to have you on the program again. And I know you know a lot about other human service areas like aged care, so it'd be great to probably come on the program talk about that too. So thank you so much for coming on the program today, Dr. Bob Davidson, and sharing your extensive knowledge about the neoliberal path that consecutive governments have taken us while they've stepped back from the running and responsibility largely for our human services. And it's been quite illuminating and only leading to more questions. So I look forward to us talking again.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners for turning in on into Think Again live on 3CR Community Radio today. If you want to contact us or comment on our program, please email Borderlands, borders@borderlands.org.au. Our programs are available by podcast on a variety of platforms and the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. To end our program for today, please enjoy Milkumana by King Stingray. Milkumana!
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.